Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, August the 17th. And as we like to do from time to time, we like to check with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor, and take a look at the politics. We're going to be looking at three areas, 2020 and the Democrats and what's happening over there with the Democrats. We're also going to talk about the U.S. Senate. Let's see what is the latest information that Barry has on the U.S. Senate. And we're also going to talk about some of this polling data that is going around. I just read something today that right now in August of 1983, the middle of August 1983, President Reagan was around 40% in the polls, not looking very strong. And what, a year... 4 months later, 16 months later, he went on to win a substantial re-election. So you cannot take these polls completely, and we've talked about that with Barry before. Let me say hello to our friend Barry Castleman. How's everything up in Minnesota, Barry?
It's cool and delightful.
Wonderful. Well, we have a little bit of baseball trivia tonight. I just wanted to briefly mention the Minnesota Twins are in town to play the Rangers, and that is a great trivia question. Both of these teams used to be the Washington Senators at one time. Are you there?
Yes, they were the Senators.
They were. The Minnesota Twins were the Washington Senators, and then the second edition of the Washington Senators became the Texas Rangers.
Right.
In 1972.
Clark Griffith owns the team here in Minnesota and in Washington, as I believe.
Yeah. And he took the team to Minnesota for the 61 season. And then the American League was granted another franchise in Washington, the Washington Senators. And then that team came to Texas in 1972. So... It's always, you know, it's always a little baseball trivia question when the Twins and the Rangers played, because of their original names, the Washington Senators, at one time. Well, today we're going to talk a little politics, but let me begin with that point I brought up about President Reagan at this point in the summer, August of 1983, at 40% approval, and then a year. 3 months later, 15 months later, he wins a massive re-election. I guess my point is it's tough to predict what's going to happen, Barry.
Right. Well, the polls, and even then, the polls, the national polls, meant something. The problem today, and this is very important, and it's helped me predict the 2016 election, is there national polls are meaningless. Even if the national polls were accurate, remember, they weigh their responses according to population. So the largest states are California, New York, Illinois, are the three states which Democrats carry by huge net margins. So in a national poll, that will be reflected. But the election is not a popular vote election. It's an electoral college vote election. And therefore, California, New York, and Illinois are basically irrelevant. They are going to be won almost for certain, by whomever is the Democratic nominee. What you want to know are the state polls, those states which are competitive in the presidential race. As they were in 2016, that was Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa. And when you look at those states, and the media sort of ignored it, and so did most mm-hmm. of the pundits, and therefore they were caught off guard because after all, there were no real landslides for Trump in those states. He won mm-hmm. by relatively narrow margins, but he won them. And he won those electoral college votes, and he was elected president.
Mm-hmm.
So,
let me ask you.
If you take away California, New York, and Pennsylvania in the national polls, suddenly you don't have 43% or 44 or 45% for and 51 or 52% against. It's the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And the president's numbers are well over 50% in those states which are competitive. Now, we don't know that, but in fact, you will notice today that more and more of the news media, especially those which are most honorable and most trying to be fair,
mm-hmm.
are ignoring the national polls and are only using state polls. For example, Ballotpedia, which is the online encyclopedia of American politics, which I work with, they almost exclusively use state polls because they understand, as anyone who follows this does, that the national polls are don't tell us anything about how the election is going to turn out. It tells us how the popular vote is going, but the popular vote is not relevant to the election of the president
right.
because it's an electoral college vote.
Let me ask you another question. State polls. I mean, of course, being I don't follow. Living in Texas, I only see the state polls for Texas. But how reliable are the state polls that you look at around the country? I mean, do you feel like Minnesota, for example? Minnesota. I just sent you an email that Minnesota is starting. It's beginning to look a little bit more purple, maybe potentially a Republican state. Not a Republican state, but the Republicans could actually win there.
Well, they almost won last time.
But yeah, that's right.
The state polls, I've noticed that most of the state polls are anywhere from 300 to 600 sample. That's
mm-hmm.
pretty small, especially
mm-hmm.
when they're under closer to 300. The thought you must always look for, and that's what I counsel everybody to pay attention to, is, first of all, if they were just general voters or even registered voters, again, meaningless, because they aren't. They're really an indication of who's going to vote. What you need are likely voters, and even that is a guess, but at least that's a more educated guess. And then you want to look at the sample, and you want to have an idea. So even the state polls, especially at this point, are of some question, but they're at least more indicative of where this election is going. I mean, when I say state polls, I don't mean a state poll in North Dakota in Rhode Island. Those are states which are already virtually for sure determined. What you
mm-hmm.
have is anywhere from 8 to 14 states somewhere in there which are potentially or are potentially competitive. And one of those lately has been, the media said, is Texas, which, of course, you know much more about than I do. And
mm-hmm.
in my private conversations with you, you say that you don't think Texas is really that competitive. But the media is trying to say it is.
Right.
So, again, do we have any evidence of that from the polls? Well, the polls are all we really have at this point. But they have to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, if you become poll dependent, you risk making missing the boat, as
most right.
people did in 2016.
Yeah, if you become poll dependent, then you're going to suffer what I like to call a 2016 surprise, where everybody was caught off guard, except for you, Barry. I mean, that's the truth. I mean, you were on top of it back then. But let me just say something about Texas, that I think some pundits are saying that Texas is tilting Democrat. And it is. I mean, the population cannot be denied. It's probably not going to be as red anymore as it used to be. But it's still, I think, red. And if you look at 2018, that was, I think, almost like, I like to think of it as like pitching a perfect game and losing the game. Because everything was going the Democrat way. You had $80 million in here for Beto O'Rourke. A lot of that was used to register people. I mean, they registered just about everybody they could. They turned out just about everybody they could. And they still lost. I mean, they didn't win a single statewide race. In fact, the closest one was the Ted Cruz race by 3 points. All the other ones were between 5 and 10 points. And that's despite having a tremendous registration effort and, as I say, you know, spending a lot of money, getting a lot of people to vote straight party, which is what they did. So that's why I'm not inclined to think that Texas is competitive for the Democrats. I think there may be other better examples like Arizona and Colorado maybe. Those may be better examples, I think, Barry.
Could be. I mean, certainly we'll get later to the Senate races. Certainly those are some of the races which are relatively few races which are competitive this cycle. But there are states, and there are both states, both sides. For example, Minnesota and Virginia and New Mexico and Nevada all went for Hillary Clinton, and New Hampshire. But all of those could go for Donald Trump this time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's still way too early, but I just thought it was fascinating because you go back to 1971 and you have almost a similar. I know you've been covering politics for a long time, and 72, I believe, was your first campaign. And you go back to 1971 and you also have at this stage, August 1971, President Nixon also not exactly with very high approval ratings. And then he turns around 15 months later and he wins 49 states, which gets to my point that I think that the problem with these polls right now is that we're not really looking at the two people who will be running against each other. We got President Trump on one side. We know him, but we don't know who the other person is. And,
right.
You know, in the summer of 1971, I don't know I don't remember as well as you do, but was George McGovern considered to be the likely nominee at that point? I mean, I think there were other names like Ed Muskie, even Hubert Humphrey at that time. And in 1983.
Muskie was clearly the front runner.
Yeah, that's right. And then in 1983, as I recall, there were people like Senator John Glenn who were being talked about. In fact, Glenn was leading President Reagan in many of the polls. And then we ended up with Walter Mondale. And a booming economy in 1984, which is obviously helpful to Reagan. But anyway, I just predict these predictions are so hard to make. And then, of course, one more, Barry, that I'm sure you're very familiar with. At this point in 1991, the first Bush was unbeatable. I mean, nobody could touch him. And then Ross Perot turned that around. So many things can happen. And that's why I caution people not to get too excited about these polls, just like you told me, Barry.
Right. And also, as of now, I'm not saying it won't happen, but as of now, none of the Democratic candidates, we have a couple people who are scoring well in the polls, and Joe Biden remains closely, he's being challenged, but he's still the front runner, but nobody is running away with the race, and nobody is really exciting the grassroots of the Democratic Party yet. I'm not saying they
right.
won't. I'm not saying the Democrats can't win the presidency. But right now, almost all the actions on the Republican side, the president is of course, a notorious scene stealer. He has a unique skill in stealing media attention, even though it's often unfavorable. But at least the media pays much more attention to him that it does to the Democrats, and that's a very serious problem for
yeah.
the Democrats.
Yeah, it just seems like President Trump is always on the – I mean, he is the president, so he would be on the front page. But he's on the front page, it seems to me, a lot more than other presidents I recall. And so, I mean, look at this trip of these two congresswomen to Israel. He turned it around into a political event. You know, he was the one who – I'm not saying that he forced Israel to deny entry to these people because I think Israel can think for itself. But I'm just simply saying he made it a political issue back here, Barry.
Right. Well, I mean, it was pretty much a – I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding people who think that somehow Ilhan Omar, especially Ilhan Omar – who was a stated enemy of the Israeli government? Why the Israelis would allow her to enter Israel? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Israel, on the other hand, was originally willing to do so. In fact, and they had both. Ilhan Omar and AOC were welcomed if they had gone with the delegations of each of their parties to Israel, which did go last month or a month or two ago, and they decided not to. And now AOC's been offered a visa to visit her grandmother on the West Bank, and she says no. So obviously it's a set-up deal.
Right.
And you know, I mean, after all, why would you allow your sworn enemy to enter your country? I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Well, I mean, if one just thinks about what these two ladies have said about Israel, I mean, recently they were behind this boycott of Israel, and one of them referred to Israel as Nazi Germany, and I'm just sitting there saying, how can anybody say that? At Israel without realizing that that was going to generate a tremendous backlash. That would be like somebody showing up at my home with a T-shirt of Che Guevara. I mean, it's like right in your face type of thing. And so when these ladies say that Israel is Nazi Germany, I mean, I would expect most Israelis to be very angry at this. I mean, because that's really the ultimate insult to call Israel
Nazi Germany.
Clearly,
they were clearly not. They were really going to cause as much trouble as they could when they made their visit. So it made no sense.
Right.
But they were holding back when the president indicated how strongly he opposed it. I think it made it much more easy. As you point out, Israel can make up its own mind, but I think it made it a lot easier.
Oh, absolutely. But I think the larger point of this is that it was President Trump who was making news, not the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats were being forced to defend these two women, congresswomen, whereas President Trump was defending Israel, if I could put it that way.
Right.
And I think that's probably politically a better position. Well, I want to talk about the 2020 Democrats and begin with an article that you wrote about the possibility of another candidate getting in. And tie that to the 2020 Democrats. But let's do this. Let me take a break, and then we'll come back. We can do a whole segment on your article on the Democrats, and then we can do a follow-up on the U.S. Senate. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor, right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, as we like to do from time to time. We chat with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor up in Minnesota. Barry, you wrote an article about the 2020 election and the possibility of a new candidate jumping in. So why don't we start with that and then take us to the 2020 Democrats and how you see the race at this moment. What are some of your thoughts about the people running and you know, what they're going to do here? They have another 5 or 6 months before they get to Iowa, Barry.
Well, I wrote a piece saying there were there was some unease among Democrats nationwide about the, even though they have a huge field of now 24 candidates, as many as 20, at one point 26. And even that was that large, no one seems to be standing out. And there was a call by some Democrats for new candidates, most notably Mrs. Obama, Oprah Winfrey, Mr. Bloomberg, and Mark Cuban, all of whom are either billionaires or millionaires or are extremely well known. And so they can enter a campaign even later than this and still make a run for it. I understand that Mrs. Obama has issued a statement saying she will not be a candidate. I concluded that no one else was going to get in the race this late. I mean, it's always possible. Mr. Steyer, of course, just got in, and he's a billionaire and able to qualify through advertising and whatever to qualify for the debates. I guess there are 9 of the candidates have already qualified. 5 are very close, and another 3 or 4 look like they will eventually be make it for the debates. So we'll get close to 20 candidates, and we'll still have 2 debates. And several, Mr. Delaney and a couple others, who are not likely to qualify for some of the 3rd and 4th debates, saying they're staying in the race nevertheless. And the debates, turned out, are not exactly what I think the Democrats hoped they would be. I think, to a certain extent, as I think you pointed out, the first debate was a bit of a disaster. They all, in one debate, they attacked Mr. Biden, Ms. Harris, Senator Harris, made a brief run, but her campaign does not seem to be going anywhere. In fact, although currently there's polling that shows Senator Warren is making a bit of a rise at the expense of Mr. Biden, he's still ahead in most polls. And really, it's inconclusive because we don't have any votes. And one of the things I've been pointing out is that Senator, former Vice President Biden, former Senator Biden, and Senator Bernie Sanders have a huge base of support. And they don't particularly care about flubs or this or that that are being reported by the media and which are being, every detail is happening. They just like their candidate. And so you can't write them off. I'm not saying either of them are going to win. I'm just saying that the Democratic contest is getting very complicated. And instead of it winnowing down to 2 or 3 candidates, or even 5, as some of the media have suggested, I think there's still going to be about 10 to 15 candidates in this race when we have the first voting in Iowa and New Hampshure.
Barry, excuse me for 1 second.
The race is very inconclusive. There is some suggestion, I have made the suggestion, that it's starting to smell a bit like, and this affects both parties, 64 when Barry Goldwater ran and really had no chance to win. In 72 when George McGovern ran against Nixon and he really didn't have much of a chance. And 84
right.
when, as you pointed out, when Mondale ran and he didn't really, he lost 49 states. So it looks like, and also maybe 96 when Bob Dole ran and really had no chance to defeat Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton,
and then in 2008, excuse me, when Barack Obama ran against John McCain, and really after that debacle with the savings and loan, there was no chance for the Republican
to win.
So it's just, there are races such as 2016, which was relatively close. In fact, mm-hmm. the Democrat did win the popular vote, or 2000, where the same thing happened, where the races, or even 2004, when it was relatively close between mm-hmm. John Kerry and George Bush. But this is starting to begin to look like a race where it may not be a close race. Now, that,
right.
I'm not making a prediction.
No,
things
I understand.
Can change very quickly.
No, they can. But let me ask you a question, because this is something that is confusing me, and maybe you can help me understand this better. And I'm sure some people in the audience are confused as I am. I was under the impression that the DNC was going to bring the number down to 7 by the next debate. And now, if I understood you correctly, you're saying there may be more than 7 in the next debate?
There are already 9.
Oh, my goodness. So they're not going to be able to have 7.
No, no. And 5 are almost there. So you can be almost sure there'll be 14 to 15 candidates.
Wow.
For sure. And maybe another 4 or 5, because there's plenty of time for them to get what they need to get.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone who told you that they were going to get down to 7 doesn't know what they're talking about.
Well, I was under the impression, you know, again, I was getting that from media reports, and obviously media reports are not always, as you know, not always the best, but that was the impression I had, that they were going to bring it down to 7. And then the question I asked when I heard that about 7 was, how are they going to decide the last 3? I mean, the first 4 are fairly easy: Sanders, Warren, Mr. Biden, and Senator Harris. I mean, those 4 probably, you know, those probably get in no matter what scenario. But then there's like about 5 or 6 of them, like for the next 3 positions, that, to use a baseball analogy, they're all within a game of each other. And how do you decide, you know, which one gets in? Is it 2.1, 2.2? And I mean, it really is ridiculous, you know? So anyway, thank you for clarifying that. I was under the impression that it was going to be 7 by the next debate. So the other problem, too, is you take a fellow like Beto O'Rourke. Beto O'Rourke does not have any intention of getting out, because he's got plenty of money to hang around for as long as he has to, Barry.
Right, but he's going. He, like Senator Klobuchar up here in Minnesota, who has qualified and who has some money, but not going anywhere. I mean, Senator Klobuchar in neighboring Iowa, where she would be expected to win, is in 8th or 9th place. And in Wisconsin, similarly, the neighboring states. And I'm not so sure she's going to win Minnesota, because I think Senator Sanders and now Ms. Senator Warren is coming here this week. So the Klobuchar campaign, for now anyway, is not going anywhere. Beto O'Rourke is not going anywhere, because Mayor Pete of South Bend stole his thunder. And then there's Mrs. Williamson and others who are sort of interesting characters who aren't going away. John Delaney, Mr. Hickenlooper is gone.
Mm-hmm.
May run. We'll talk about it when we get to the Senate races. He may run for the Senate in Colorado, though he has a problem if he does.
Mm-hmm.
But the there are a number of candidates who aren't going anywhere now, but I think there's a hope that over, you know, because we got another several months to go before the first caucus and mm-hmm. primary, and who's going to fill up that time? Meanwhile, you got a guy in the White House who can steal the news cycle every day easily, even
That's
against
right.
the hostile
yeah, he,
press.
He. That's exactly right. I mean, he's in there every single – it's amazing. I have not seen that before from an American president. I mean, Bill Clinton was pretty good at stealing the news, or making the news, I think. But, man, Reagan was pretty good at it too, but it was a different time. You know, you didn't have the internet and all
that
stuff.
One example, I wrote about it in my new piece I just posted.
Yes.
He was thinking about buying Greenland.
Yes, that's right.
By the way, not his original idea. Harry Truman had that idea when he was president. And but and funny, it sounds funny, but then when you think about it, if we could buy it. Denmark owns it, and they're not going to sell it. But if we could, it would be a strategic masterpiece because it's located, its location, and it has mineral sources. I mean, it would be a buying Alaska or buying the Louisiana Purchase.
Right. Well, Alaska, as you know,
but from your history,
that was unpopular.
Was filled with him thinking about buying Alaska. He comes up with these things all the time. I'm not saying they make a lot of sense. And this one made a certain sense, although it isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But he can do this at will.
Yeah, but here's something else about President Trump, too. You mentioned that President Truman had suggested that before. I didn't know that. But he seems to have a knack, and I don't know whether he has excellent research or just himself researches this. I don't know. But, for example, when he attacked the city of Baltimore and when he went after Elijah Cummings and said the things that he said about Baltimore, everything that he said about Baltimore was basically repeating what some Democrat had said about Baltimore. Now you have this thing with Greenland where everybody says, this is really crazy. Well, it turns out that President Truman made the same suggestion. So do you think that's just a coincidence, or is he actually calculates these things so that when they say, well, you're crazy, he says, well, so was Harry Truman, I guess, crazy for suggesting the same thing. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I think President Trump plays to his base and to independent mm-hmm. voters. He doesn't care, I believe, I'm guessing, he doesn't particularly care what Democrats or the media think. In fact, he may, by getting them so upset, he actually helps himself in many cases. I'm not saying that I always agree with him or think that all his things he says and does are right, but the fact is he has survived so much that I think very few other politicians, man or woman, could survive.
Right.
He's certainly a unique figure. And I've already said whether he leaves in 2020 or 2024, after he leaves, the American people are going to have a letdown, even if they don't like him, because they're so used to his antics, his provocations, his media domination.
Mm-hmm.
It'll seem so boring.
Right.
No matter who else.
Well, his enemies are definitely going to have a hard time because, I mean, he generates reactions from, you know, from his enemies like I have not seen in American politics. I thought Richard Nixon generated a reaction, particularly during Watergate. But, again, it was a different time. You didn't have the Internet back then and the cable news and all of that.
President Roosevelt did, too.
Really? Okay.
He had, I mean, it's before you and I were born.
Sure.
But the fact is, President Roosevelt, especially in his early days, even later on, first of all, the media hated him. That's
mm-hmm.
why he did the fireside chats to go around the media. And a lot of Republicans, a lot of people thought he was a bad guy. He was very popular. He won four
mm-hmm.
terms. But we forget that he was how controversial he was in his own time. We forget that. Other presidents, President Lincoln was
mm-hmm,
reviled.
Yeah, of course. Oh, of course, yeah.
And now we consider him our greatest president. So history has a wonderful way of duplicating itself, never repeating itself exactly,
mm-hmm.
but duplicating things and, you know, reviving things. And so we have to remember that Trump is opposed by many people and feel strongly. But presidents have always presidents who've done things or tried to do things, who've tried to make changes, always provoke a reaction.
Right. Well, no, none more than President Truman himself, who left the presidency very unpopular, as I'm sure you know from. From your history, I mean, he was, I think, at 27% approval or something like that when he left the presidency. I think the big, you know, I wanted to say one quick thing about the Democrats. We'll take a break and then we'll do a whole segment on the Senate. But I think the biggest problem with these Democrats running against President Trump is that there isn't one of them who's chosen to take a center-right position. I'm not saying conservative, but just more center right, and talk about things that I think are more relevant to the general electorate. I mean, they all seem to be pandering to the same extreme, and I don't understand why, because that's not how you win elections, Barry.
Well, of course, we have to remember that you are a Republican and a conservative,
sure.
Number one. Number two, I don't think the word is center-right. I think the word is center-left because, I mean, Biden and Delaney and Hickenlooper were pretty much the few people who were really center-left with the word emphasis on center. The others were center, were left, progressive, or extreme left. But you're right, there's only three or four candidates, and the only one who really, in the public mind, represents a more moderate course is Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And he has some other issues which seem to be holding him back, but he's still the front runner. And I think, remember what I've always said, you know, right now there's some polls, there's some media comments, there's some partisan activist advocacy, but we still haven't heard from any voters.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And voters, I've always believed, that both Democrats and Republicans, are more moderate than the extremes of their bases. So the
mm-hmm.
more right-wing Republicans don't really represent the mass of Republicans,
mm-hmm.
and the
That's
more
right.
left-wing Democrats don't really represent the mass of the Democrats. But we'll find out the answer to that when we have our actual voting in caucuses and primaries. But right now, it's just speculative.
That's right. No, you're exactly right. Let's take one more break, and then when we come back, we'll get into the U.S. Senate with our friend Barry Kosselman. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're chatting with our friend Barry Kosselman, the Prairie editor. We have a link to Barry's website in the show information. Make sure you click on that and check out his amazing website, the Prairie editor. Barry, let's devote a pretty good segment here to the U.S. Senate races and how you see them at this stage of the game. I know, again, it's early, but for at least here in Texas, we have Senator Cornyn running for re-election. He seems to be running unopposed on the Republican side. And then there is like four or five Democrats running for the nomination. Royce West, who is a Democrat here from the Dallas area. He's a state senator. There's a couple of other activists who are running. I don't think they have much of a chance. And then there's a lady who had military experience who's also running, but my guess is that it's going to be Royce West again, Senator Cornyn, and my guess at this point is that Cornyn will win, fairly easily. But that's Texas. How do you see some of the others, Barry?
Well, as you know, it's the reverse of 2018, when the Republicans had the advantage. There were more than twice as many Democratic incumbents up for re-election, or their seats were up for re-election. And so it was a lot easier for the Republicans to make some gains, which they did. They picked up two seats, not as many as they thought they would and hoped they would, but they still picked up some seats. But the reverse is true this time. And so on the face of it, the Democrats should have reason to be optimistic. But the problem for them in this particular cycle is that most of the incumbents in both parties really don't have competitive races. Now, there are a few. In fact, there's about four or five on each side that are potentially competitive. And you could potentially, if it's really a rout for the Democrats this time. You could see the Senate go back to the Democratic Party. Much if it's a route for the president, which could happen too, then you have the possibility that even under these numerical disadvantaged circumstances, the Republicans could actually pick up a seat or two, net gain. I think in the end it'll be probably close to what it is now, which is 53-47, with probably one or two seats changed either way. The Republicans have two really competitive races, Colorado and Arizona. And Arizona, I think, is really, even though the incumbent who was appointed after she lost the 2018 election to the Democrat, she's the most endangered because she has a very serious opponent in Arizona on the Democratic side. Cory Gardner is the incumbent in Colorado. He, on paper, he's in trouble. He's not polling well. But they don't really have, they have a number of, they have 15 candidates. Mr. Hickenlooper was thinking of running, who pulled out of the presidential race, is thinking about it, and he's actually polling well. But the most of the 15 candidates have reacted to the possibility he might get in the race very negatively and are very bitter, and that could be a problem. So, and Cory Gardner is a very effective senator in many ways. I think it's a close race. He could lose, but it depends on, I think, on the presidential race to a large extent. Now, there's another race in Kansas where the Republicans should win. There's a retirement, but a very controversial candidate for governor, Republican, who lost what normally would be a sure race, is thinking of running again, as is Roy Moore in Alabama, where the Democrat was elected in 2018, and which normally would go back to the Republicans. But so the Republicans are risking self-immolation once again, as they have done so many times in the last 12 years, with some of their Senate candidates, picking candidates in races that they almost certainly would win, and then throwing the race away. And that would certainly happen if Roy Moore were the nominee of their nominee in Alabama, and probably the candidate in Kansas. So we have those races. On the Democratic side, Alabama normally would be a pickup, and then there are three races that I think are competitive. New Hampshire now, Mr. Lewandowski, endorsed by the president, and that's going to be would be a close race anyway, and now he's potentially a serious candidate against Senator Shaheen. In Michigan, Gary Peters is, even though he's the incumbent, hardly anybody knows who he is, and he's got a very, very, very charismatic opponent, John James, who almost pulled off an upset in 2018 and who could, again, has the strong support of the president. And Michigan is a state, like New Hampshire, that could go Republican in 2020. And then finally, there's Minnesota, where Tina Smith, who did win, clearly won against a weak opponent in 2018, but could face a more serious opponent this time, although I must tell you that as of now, there's two main opponents, and it's not clear that the Republicans will pick their strongest opponent for Tina Smith. And if they don't, or they go into a bruising primary, Tina Smith will be elected. On the other hand, that race is potentially competitive. So we have those races which are competitive. Most of the other races are not. Of course, things can change. We could get some more retirements. Although, for example, retirements in Tennessee, where the Republican retired, isn't going to affect the result, and the same in New Mexico, where the Democrat is retiring. But that's going to be replaced with a Democrat, almost certainly. So the Senate races, however, I believe that the real action other than the presidential race is the Senate. I'm not particularly optimistic for the Republicans in the House, although anything could happen. But there's been numerous retirements of Republican incumbents, and in your own state of Texas,
mm-hmm.
and in California and elsewhere. And I'm not sure that the necessary 20 seats could be picked up by Republicans unless it's a landslide for the president. On the other hand, in the Senate, I think the odds currently slightly favor the Republicans, at least holding their own or maintaining close to 52 to 48 or 51-49 lead. Of course, then what comes into play, of course, is who wins the election, because who is the elected vice president, who becomes the president of the Senate and is a deciding vote if there's a tie. So it mm-hmm. gets very complicated. But I think the real action is in the Senate. I think both sides have generally recruited well. Certainly the Democrats have recruited very well in Arizona, although I understand that the favorite, the husband of the former of the congressman woman who
yes. was
shot,
mm-hmm.
Is facing a primary from an Arizona Democratic congressman. So
mm-hmm.
it's all complicated. Both parties are often guilty of complicating their own situations because of egos or ambitions of individuals who don't necessarily have the party's interest at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that particularly true among Republicans. And
yeah.
we'll see now if they can avoid some of the pitfalls that they have fallen into in the past.
Well, Alabama, to be sure, because Roy Moore is the only one who could reelect Doug Jones at this point.
Right.
I mean, so Alabama is, I think the Republicans there better need to get their act together and make sure that it's anybody but Roy Moore. Because, you know, even Roy Moore only lost by 18,000 votes, so it's not like Doug Jones has a lot to go there. But that would be, yeah, that would be one. I hope the party in Alabama does the right thing. Let me ask you another question, and then we'll have to go. This is a larger question about, you mentioned primaries. I get the impression, I could be wrong, that a lot of the left is going to primary many of the members of the House, some of the more moderate members. Is that true, or is that just a lot of noise from what
you're
hearing?
Well, they're going to do it in places like New York City.
Okay.
And San Francisco and Los Angeles, heavily Democratic areas where you have very liberal incumbents, but they're not radical enough for the far
mm-hmm.
left, and they're going to primary of some. That's what kind of happened in Minnesota, has happened elsewhere, and sometimes they succeed. But all that does, however, is creates an image of the Democratic Party outside those districts,
mm-hmm.
of a party that's gone too far to the left, just as whenever that occurred on the Republican side, when candidates who were much too conservative
mm-hmm.
for outside their, I mean, they were able to win in their districts sometimes. Mr. Moore did not, because
mm-hmm.
he was just too unacceptable. But
right.
Then the Democrats portrayed the ultra-conservative members to the rest of the state or the other districts, saying, "This is, do you want this?"
Right.
Same
right.
is true on the Democratic side. So it's a. But you're right. There is movements ahead, not only in congressional seats, but also in other races, attorney general, district attorney in New York, all kinds of races where you have more radical candidates running against it.
Right.
Otherwise, popular incumbents.
Well, that's how AOC got in, basically.
Right.
I mean, she ran against an incumbent who took it for granted, I guess, and ended up losing to this young woman, Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, in the Bronx. Well, Barry, we got to do it again. Very interesting information from you tonight. And as always, we're grateful. Keep up the great work at the Prairie Editor. We have a link to it.
How did the Rangers do
always,
tonight?
Well, they're caught up in the last I checked, it was 8-6 Minnesota in the fourth inning. So pitching is not going well tonight. I don't know about the Yankees. They played this afternoon, and the flash that I saw was that the Yankees and the Dodgers have the two best records in Major League Baseball right now.
Wow.
So that could be a preview of the World Series, another Yankee-Dodgers World Series. I'm sure you remember those growing up.
Yes.
Of course, back then the Dodgers were in Brooklyn when that happened. Although
Roy
they
Campanella.
Did have a couple. Yeah, that's right. But it did happen, I think. Was it in 63 when the Yankees and the Dodgers played?
I don't remember
and they
what
were,
year it was.
Yeah, they were already in L.A., and then, of course, there were several in the late 70s when the Yankees and the Dodgers met in the World Series. That has always been my favorite World Series, when the Yankees and the Dodgers meet, because it just seems like it's always baseball history, no matter what happens.
Right.
So I love those. Barry, thank you for your time, and thank you very much for the information, and we'll do it again probably maybe in early October and get a glimpse of what's going on.
Thank you, Silvio.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, as always. Good night. Good night to you. Thank you very much. Well, it's always a lot of fun when we chat with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. As I said, we have a link to his website on the show information. Click on that and see what he's saying. I love what he writes. I mean, I'm just absolutely a big believer in the Prairie Editor. It's a wonderful resource. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.